This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik. The COVID-19 pandemic itself, as well as the measures taken to mitigate its spread, have really upended our lives for the past few months and is expected to continue to impact us for at least several more months to come. So what impact will it have on our mental and emotional well-being? How will we cope and even change in the long run? On the line with me to discuss this is Dr. Joel Lau, clinical psychologist. How are you doing, Dr. Joel?
I am good. Thanks for having me today.
It's a pandemic that has left virtually no one untouched.
Yep.
Many people in many countries around the world, about 2.6 billion people actually, are living under some kind of lockdown or quarantine measures that are quite ranging in their intensity or severity. So let's look at what impact or what kind of toll would it take on our mental well-being?
Mm-hmm. I think this lockdown is unprecedented, right? This is something none of us, most of us at least, would not have experienced something like this before. So I think for a lot of researchers, especially from the psych perspective, right, we're still trying to find out what this is going to do to us mentally. But I think across the board, we can see a lot of evidence of people who are not comfortable with the lockdown, right? I think physically, we are not meant to be confined to four walls at all times. I think that's definitely taking a toll on a lot of us. But mentally as well, I think there are some of us who are better prepared or better suited to being in the lockdown and some of us who are not. So as the memes and the posts on Facebook and Instagram shows, like, those people who are more naturally introverted, they seem to be doing a bit better than the more extroverted ones who thrive on the social contact and social interactions with other people. Right? But I think by and large, the big toll I think that's taking on us is the fact that we've had to switch from a modality where we go out to work and come back home to a modality where we are working and staying at home, and being at home is all wrapped up in one thing. And I think having to make that switch in our minds, both physically and also mentally, I think that's causing a big, it's a big shift for a lot of people in that sense, right?
So meaning we no longer have that separation between going out where that's our place of work, and then when we come home, it's sort of like our place of, I don't know, sanity and solace.
Yeah, exactly that. Mm. I think when we lose that, especially, and you'd be surprised how powerful that physical movement is, in that sense. Like when we go to the office, I'm at the office, right? Mm-hmm. And then when I leave the office, I leave my work at the office, and then I come back home. It's a very powerful aspect of our being, in that sense, right? Mm. So now that everything is wrapped up together in one giant ball, I think what's starting to happen to a lot of people is that they're finding it hard to separate both ways. Like, they don't know when work starts and when home begins, right? So if I've got kids and my kid wakes up earlier than usual, for example, or later than usual, that just disrupts my whole day and I can't go to work, for example, and things like that. Mm-hmm. I've got a meeting randomly at 4 o'clock and my kid, needs to go potty at 4 o'clock, what do I do? I think that takes a lot, big toll on a lot of people in that sense.
Mm. What about for people who typically perhaps more home-based already, perhaps the older retirees, stay-at-home parents, how would this affect them?
I think it's different, right? So for those of us who are used to being at home, right? So either you work from home typically anyway, or your house husband or housewife, or you're from the more elderly generation, retired generation. I think the impact is more about the flexibility of movement, right? So mm-hmm. like in the past, if my parents, for example, wanted to come and visit my kids, they could just say, hey, we're coming over, and they'll come over in 5 minutes, right? That's fine. But now they can't, right? And I think it's that lack of control, the lack of ability to dictate where am I going to be, where I want to be, I think that can be quite troubling for that population as well. So I think that's how the elderly will be affected by that, I think.
And what kind of mental health issues that would we see manifesting in the long run? Because it's not just about feeling uncomfortable now, it's about looking ahead.
I think for a lot of people, the most common things that I think would arise is definitely one is anxiety. I think this lockdown, what it's done is just to really accentuate and bring to the fore the fear and the anxiety around COVID-19 and the whole virus kind of thing. Right? I mean, for countries, not only our country, but multiple countries across the world to actually shut down entire countries and industries and work and all that because of that virus, it just goes to show how powerful and how dangerous it can be. So once this is done, right, I think the anxiety of going out there is still going to be very rampant for a long time at least, right? So even our DG of health is saying things like, I think we need to move away from a culture of shaking hands to one like we bow like the Chinese or Japanese or what have you, because that's the new norm, and the new normal and the new reality that we're heading towards, right? And that fear is always going to be there. You know, when's the next big pandemic going to happen? When's the next back infection going to happen, right, for example? Another one that I think is going to be quite common is also this depression, right? And I think that reason for that is because, number one, you're cooped up at home right now. Having to balance work and having to balance your own life and your social aspects of your life is going to be very, very difficult. Then when you come out again, it's taken you, what, a month, 2 months to get used to this work from home kind of environment. And suddenly you're being asked to reverse all that and then go back to optimum performance levels when you go back to work. That's not going to happen overnight, right? I was just telling someone I was speaking to today that it's going to take everyone at least, what, a couple of weeks in the minimum just to get us back up to speed to how we were like before the lockdown, right? You think about how long it took for us to get used to the lockdown right now, it's going to take that much time to get us out of the lockdown kind of phase, like that sense. Mm. So I think depression is going to be quite rampant as well, because the transitioning, some people don't take it too well, right? And also the loss of things that are going on, like some people are getting retrenched, for example, furloughed. Some people are losing half their incomes because of budget cuts and things like that. Again, that's a lot of pressure to be taking all at once, like, in a sense. So I think it's going to be compiling on a lot of people. So I think these are going to be two of the main issues that are going to affect the people of Malaysia and elsewhere in the world as well.
Mm. And when we talk about lockdowns or MCO, whatever you want to call it, there's a couple of factors. There's how severe, I suppose, the measures are. There's also the duration of it. Does the impact on our mental well-being differ depending on how aggressive the measures are, or even how it's sort of dealt out to us, right? Being told about it 2 weeks and then another 2 week extension and another one, as opposed to, okay, prepare for 6 weeks and there you go, you know?
Yeah. I think definitely the severity and the manner in which it rolls out, it definitely plays a big role. Right? So we start with the severity one. Like for example, in Wuhan, China, there was like a massive lockdown. You literally couldn't leave your homes and there was military roaming the streets kind of thing. When the lockdown is so hard, so fast, I think the shock and all kind of factors is going to affect a lot of people, right? Because you go from living a normal, relatively normal life to one where you're basically confined, like you're imprisoned in your own home, right? And that in on its own can be very traumatic for a lot of people, especially for people who are used to going out and engaging with people outside and all that kind of things. And on top of that, like I said earlier on, right, we are very social creatures. We like interacting with people. We like leaving. We like mobility, like in that sense, right? So in countries where the lockdown is very much more severe, like in China, for example, and we literally can't get out of the house, then you're confined in a small space, right? And that can be very troubling physically, of course, because you don't get to work out and things like that. But mentally as well, you're staring at the same four things day in and day out and can get very detrimental. Now, for the calmer lockdowns, like what we had at the very beginning, right, where it wasn't as strict, for example, and we're still able to go out to the park, or if I live in a condo, for example, walk around the compound, then it was still actually quite helpful, because then we saw a bit of green, we could get some fresh air, and we could still say hi to neighbors and things like that, which is still quite nice. But now that it's been locked down quite severely, that goes away, I think you can see the difference quite starkly in that sense, right? I think also the second part of the question was the first part was severity. Second one was the manner in which we're doing it. I think the manner in which we do it also is critical as well. Because if the lockdown is 6 weeks, like tell you 6 weeks up front, I think that's a reason why the government didn't do that, right? Because if you tell them it's 2 weeks, people who panic buy, they only panic buy for 2 weeks worth of groceries, all the paper and whatnot. If you do a 6 week lockdown and they're not prepared for it, I think it can drive a lot of people. The fear factor is going to ramp up a millionfold, right? I think we saw a little bit of that in Singapore as well, where people were lining up, but massive, massive queues to buy groceries and going to get some utilities and whatnot, right? So I think it's really about what's the message that you want to send out to the people, right? 6 week lockdown versus a 2 week lockdown, the severity is much greater, even though it's the same thing anyway. So I think it's smart in that sense, is managing the fear and anxiety that people have. So it's only 2 weeks, don't worry about it. Okay, now we have to extend 2 weeks. So it's like putting your foot in the door. So you've already done it for 2 weeks, so that's another 2 weeks, right? What's another 2 weeks? So it's more manageable in that sense, like in bite-sized chunks. Like,
You talked about fear, and I guess some amount of fear is needed to make sure that people take this seriously now, the fear of what the virus can do to you. So that's why you need to stay at home, right? But at what point does this fear become too much for someone to cope with?
I think it's actually happening right now already, right? I think, was it the DG or was it the police were saying that the number of traffic or the number of cars on the road is actually escalating. And I think that's the problem with fear, right? There's this study that was done on cigarette packets. You know, cigarette packets, they've got those pictures of like cancer and detrimental effects of cigarettes, right? Mm-hmm. And what they found, research found, was that it works to a certain extent. Once it gets to a point where it's excessive or over the top, it just stops working. People just tune it up. So I think that's starting to happen a little bit here in Malaysia. At the start, you know, it was scary. People were fearful and they didn't know what was going on. They didn't know how it's transmitted. So being under lockdown, being in the MCO makes sense because then I'm keeping me my own safe line, et cetera. But now we know a lot more about the MCO. People are thinking, yeah, what's all this fear about? There's nothing to be feared about. All my neighbors, you see, all of us are healthy. All my family members are healthy as well. Then it comes to a point where it's oversaturated. And I think that fear, the effectiveness of fear goes away. And I think when that happens and when it starts happening now, we need to revert back to education. The more people know or understand about COVID-19, how it's passed on, why it's important to keep not only yourself safe, but by doing so, you keep the rest of the people safe. That's the next message I think that needs to be sent out in that sense. So we move to a more knowledge-based, education-based kind of reasons why you should stay home. I think that's the next phase that we should go towards.
Okay. On the line with me is Dr. Joe Lau, a clinical psychologist, and we are talking about the impact of COVID-19 on our mental health in the long run and what we need to be looking at to mitigate those issues. Stay tuned. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiaoyik. On the line with me is clinical psychologist Dr. Joe Lau. We're looking at COVID-19, of course, as many of our issues are on the station these days, but we're looking at our mental health in the long run because we know we're sort of in it for the long haul. We've been told that this isn't going to go away anytime soon. We don't really have a clear endpoint to the movement control order. We can only sort of hope for the best as we go through day by day. And so fear, anxiety, depression are some of the issues that we really need to keep our eye on as we sort of, struggle through this every day. What about people with existing mental health issues? Looking at how being in a stay-at-home or lockdown situation right now would exacerbate those. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking specifically about substance abuse disorders.
Yeah, definitely. So I'll parcel out those two, right? So those people with mental health disorders, I think being stuck at home can be very problematic, because one of the things that we do encourage our clients to do is to live an active and full life as much as possible. Like for me, for example, I do something called CBT or cognitive behavior therapy, where we discuss the fact that it's our thoughts and our beliefs that color our world, whether it's negative or positive. So when they live active lives or full lives, it gives them different perspectives that they can rely on. Being in lockdown right now, they can't anymore, right? They only have whatever is being fed to them, which is fed through the media, which is full of crazy numbers and death tolls and things like that. And it's very debilitating, right? The good thing is that a lot of our practitioners, like myself, for example, have moved online. And I think there are also a lot of good avenues that you can reach out online to get some services through video conference or chat therapy or what have you in that sense, right? So they have access to some good quality services out there. Okay? And there are also a lot of good resources they can find on YouTube and things like that that can be very helpful to you. Yeah. Now, for people with the more chemical-based disorders like addictions to alcohol, drugs, and things like that, I think that can go either way, right? I'm thinking, on the one hand, by being confined at home, let's say you're dependent on alcohol. Oftentimes, when we use alcohol a lot, it's in social situations like in bars and clubs and things like that. So being away from those kind of situations might be useful in that sense, right? It might actually be helpful. Mm-hmm. Although the first transition, I think, might be quite difficult. And the first couple of weeks might be quite hard for you. But eventually, it might be useful in the sense that because you don't have to go there, you don't drink, and then naturally you tapers off. The issue here or the problem here is, let's say you have an access to those substances at home, right? Be it drugs or alcohol, then that can be quite problematic. Like, there are some people who are quite functional even when they're on drugs, for example, like people who take marijuana and weed and things like that, right? But because they have a job to go to the next morning, there's this natural limit break or circuit breaker kind of thing, right? Okay, by 10 o'clock, I need to stop because I need to go to work tomorrow. I need to get earn a living and whatnot, right? Mm-hmm. Now that's taken away and I get to work from home, I get to work from a computer, no one gets to see how high I am, for example, then that's going to exacerbate the problem. They're just going to say, I can be high all day. Nothing's going to stop me, right? Nothing's going to... There's no implication on me, so to speak. So I think if you do have a problem with substances or you're dependent on substances and things like that, I think it's really important that you reach out for help, either professionally or with true friends and family members as well. If nothing, just to give you like a check and balance, accountability kind of thing, right? So at least they know that you are okay, you're functioning, you're staying healthy and things like that. Yeah.
Would you see the current situation that we're in now similar to a sort of a large-scale disaster, something like 9/11 or even MH370, you know, where you'd be expecting to see a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder after that?
I think yes, right? I think honestly, this is probably going to be worse, right? Because with, I'm not diminishing 9/11 or MH370, not at all. But in those situations, when it ends, right? It was something really bad that happened and then it stopped happening and then we had to deal with the fallout after that, right? With this one, it's an ongoing kind of thing. So even after you heal, you hear stories of patients who've recovered from COVID-19 and then they fall back, they lapse back again, they get it again, right? Or that fear that they might transfer it or pass it on to family members and loved ones and things like that, right? So I think this is worse because there's no clear end in sight. It's just a perpetual kind of thing, right? I don't know whether PTSD is going to happen to the general public. It might be, because PTSD usually there's this element of perceived harm to self, right? So potentially it could happen, but I think it's going to happen more towards the frontliners, the nurses, the doctors, the patients themselves. Mm-hmm. I think they are the ones who are really at risk for PTSD, because they are day in, day out facing the terrors of dealing with this crisis and all that. Mm-hmm. The general public as well, I think definitely they are at risk as well, but not as great as the frontliners, the patients, in that sense.
You know, even if people feel that they are coping okay now, mm-hmm. what are some signs that we should actually be looking out for to indicate that we're not doing as well as we could be, or that mm-hmm. perhaps we're just running on adrenaline the whole time now and it's all going to run out at some point?
Yeah, great question. And I think the most practical answer I can give you for that question is social and occupational functioning, right? So mm-hmm. this is something that we use in our own diagnostic criteria as well, how well a person is functioning socially and also occupationally. So socially is how well they interact with their friends, family, peers, and colleagues and things like that. Occupationally is how well you're doing at work or in studies. Right? So I think during this lockdown period, you're definitely going to see some disruption, right? Especially at the start where you're learning to adapt to not seeing your colleagues, not being able to see your boyfriend or your girlfriend, not having to go to school, not going to work. So there's going to be some disruption. But if this disruption is either continues or gets worse, right? So at the start, okay, I can't see people, so I feel a bit lonely, but I can FaceTime them, I can WhatsApp them, then okay, then it's manageable. It's disrupted, but it's still manageable. But if it's gone to a point where, okay, I don't interact with people, I don't text them, they don't text me, I'm just alone 24 hours a day, then it's very problematic, really, right? Because we're losing the ability to socialize with people or the desire to socialize with people, right? Same goes occupationally as well. I think a lot of students, when they found out that, oh, cool, I've got an enforced 2-week holiday, it's like, yay, celebration, right? Mm-hmm. I get to party and get a... No, 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 party. Don't go party, guys.
No. Party in the safety of your own home.
Right, correct. Or go play games all day and all, which is great, right? But after that, the reality sinks in and you realize, okay, this is not just a 2-week thing. This is a 1-month thing, 6-week thing, 2-month thing, or however long it's going to be. And then the homework starts coming in, the assignments start coming in. And if by that time you say, okay, you know what, I'm going to spend some time and get this thing done, then you're okay. But if it gets to a point where I don't want to do it, I have no desire to do it, then that's where we say the occupational functioning has dropped in that sense. So if you notice anything about these two elements or aspects happening to yourself and it's getting either worse or not getting better, then I think it's something to be concerned about that you want to get some help for in that sense.
Would sort of like the loss of, empathy, or that's a bit hard to identify, but maybe just feeling like you don't care, you know, feeling mm-hmm. numb, would that be an indication?
Yeah, that's a good indication as well. And that's more towards the social aspect, right? Where things are happening around you, like, meh, whatever, I don't care anymore. Mm. Or, you know, there's lots of news on the situation in Europe or America, and it's like, yeah, it's just news, it's just background noise. Mm. That's often a application as well. And that usually happens to people who are burning out. There's just too much of something happening that I just cannot pay attention to anymore. I just can't focus or look at it anymore, like, in that sense. Like, right? So that's another issue as well. That's another symptom as well, definitely.
Okay, all right. And we are talking about, you know, not just some sort of physical distancing now, and it could continue in time to come where we still have to have some type of physical and social distancing. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you foresee this changing our relationships and the way that we depend on relationships as part of our nature?
I think the social elements, lah, that means like being friendly with people and interacting with people, I don't think that's going to change too much. Lah. But I think what's going to change is how we engage in those services. Lah, right? So I think in the past, you know, there's always been a preference for, let's say, dining out, for example, the preference for going out to a mama and yamcha with your friends, for example, to socialize. Right? I think that's going to change. So my desire to interact and socialize with my friends is going to maintain, but I might be doing things like, you know, going online to talk to them or doing a FaceTime call with them, for example, rather than going out to the mamak so often, right? Or going out for dinners or so, maybe that's reserved more for like special occasions rather than an every night affair kind of thing. So I think it's going to change that aspect more than how we interact with people. It's not going to change the fact that we want to interact and socialize with people. I think it's going to change how we interact with people, like, in that sense. Like. I think we've become accustomed to a certain way of being in the past pre-MCO, but after this, I think it's definitely going to change the way how we interact with people. Are definitely.
So one fundamental thing that I noticed just with the act of wearing the mask, and I find that so when I go and buy something, I can't even smile at the cashier, and it disturbed me so much because it's such a basic thing that I need to do to show that I acknowledge you as a fellow human being. You know, is it going? I guess I'm just trying to dig a bit more, you know. Is it going to change how we are as... I know you say we have to change, It's not going to change our desire to socialize. How we socialize will be different. And then how does that change our nature after that, you know?
Well, I'm an optimist, Larry. So okay. I would hope I will be optimistic in the fact that that doesn't change, right? I mean, our ability to be kind and to be loving to one another. I think I'm hoping that's what's going to carry us through, like, in that sense. But I also think there's a lot of importance that we should place in intentionality, right? Us like exactly like what you said. No, I've got a mask on. How does this person know that I appreciate his services, what they're doing for me, and I want to say thank you in a genuine kind of way when they can't see my facial expressions, they can't see me smile, for example. But the intentionality behind it is very powerful as well. You know, we can't smile and show you that I appreciate you, but I can say thank you even when you smile with the mask on. There's a crinkle in your eyes, for example. And I think the intentionality behind that is also very powerful, and I don't think we should discount that line in that sense. I think a lot of times also we smile just because we have to rather than because we want to. And I think that's not helpful as well. Right? So yes. I think going back to the intentionality of it all. And I think, honestly speaking, I mean, as crazy as MCU has been, right? I think on the plus side, right, it's actually done a lot in terms of helping people take stock of what's important to them, what's integral to them, what's important to their lives, right? I think in that aspect, it's actually been quite helpful, actually.
And, you know, everyone's turning to digital platforms for social interactions now. But are there aspects of physical interaction that the virtual form just cannot replace?
Definitely. I think one of the biggest complaints we've been getting from like clients, for example, is the fact that they don't like the virtual mediums that we have, like video conference and whatnot, right? I think there's just something different about being in the same space as someone, sharing space with someone. There's something about it that really connects you with the other person on the other end of the room, right? And I think it all boils down to the fact that as human beings, like, we're all very social creatures. And social has many elements to it. There's the communication aspect, there is the idea aspect, emotional aspect, and there's also that physical aspect, right? Just being able to shake hands with someone connects you with someone, right? Being able to hug a loved one and say, you know what, good job, congratulations, I love you. There's so much power behind it. And I think as well as we are able to move on to video conference and all that to socialize with people, right? Losing that one thing is like almost like losing a sense, like, a sensation or a limb, like, in that sense. Like, it's going to be very awkward and weird. Like. And I'm hoping that, you know, once all of this has died down, we get to come back to some semblance of that moving forward. Not yet, of course, but, you know, eventually.
So you've talked about, you know, issues that we really need to keep our eye on, anxiety and fear, well, anxiety and depression, two things that are probably going to be very widespread when we sort of get past this peak. So how well equipped are we to cope with this? And what can we do right now to mitigate that?
How equipped we are, I think, on provider level, means on a mental health provider level, I think we are not really, honestly speaking, especially from Malaysia, right? The reason why I say that is because, I'll speak from a clinical psychology point of view, there's, 200-300 of us maximum in Malaysia right now for a population of, 30 million? And most of us are in either KL or Penang, right? So that means that all those people from elsewhere, like from East Malaysia, for example, from Kuantan, from Terengganu, and all that kind of thing, they won't have ready access to someone to help them. There are counsellors, there are psychiatrists as well, but they're also bogged down by the work that they do. Honestly speaking, I don't think if we're going to rely solely on the treatment aspect of to help people get better, I think we're not ready for that, right? But I like your other question, the second part of your question. Is there anything we can do right now to prevent that from happening? And I think there are lots of good things that we can prevent mental health issues from escalating, right? So really simple things like, for example, staying social, being functional right now occupationally, so going to work, going to school, interacting with your peers and family members are really, really good ways to make sure that you are as optimum as possible. It's not going to be the best, but it's going to be not bad in that sense, right? So that regularity, that normalcy of things, right, will keep you running and keep the engine going for as long as possible, which is a really good way to prevent bad things from happening and moving forward, right? The other things that we can do is education, right? So right now, I'm pretty sure there are lots of people out there who are cooped up at home and there are lots of things happening to them, either through ruminations or this kind of ill-mannered thoughts and negative thoughts that they're having and all that kind of things, right? And it's slowly chipping away at their own mental health and sanity and emotional well-being and all that kind of good stuff, right? But because they don't have anyone to interact with, to give them light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak, to elevate some of the negativity that they're going through, is this going to keep on propagating itself nonstop, right? So I think education is really important at this moment of time. So like Mercy Malaysia, for example, they've got this entire series where they get professionals to go up there and to talk about what depression looks like, what anxiety can look like during MCO, for example. And I think that's really important because the more people know about it, the more they can identify like, oh, hang on, I'm going through this right now. This is happening to me right now. What can I do? So awareness is the first part, right? Because oftentimes people don't look for help until it's too late or until it's hit a giant brick wall. So the more education we can provide, the more people know about all these kind of things, the earlier they can identify it, and then the earlier they can do something about it. So we don't even have to go see a psychologist or a counselor or what have you in that sense, right? So I think that's the best way. Prevention right now is the best option we have. If we go into treatment, it's going to be very difficult because of the lack of resources that we have. So the more we can prevent, the better it is for everybody.
And not just treatment, if you're looking at sort of like the end point, because one thing we haven't talked about is how does a mental health crisis on such a large scale impact society as a whole? Because we are going to be looking at rebuilding the economy, sort of reviving our collective spirit, you know, and a mental health crisis is going to be a huge barrier to that, wouldn't it?
Yep, definitely. I think if for anyone, no matter how resilient you are as a person, there's only a finite amount of hits we can take before we actually break down. And it's actually normal for anybody, right? And even the strongest person are going to have moments where they crumble, right? I think the fear now is that you have so many things, right? You've got the anxiety of the virus, you've got the lockdown, you've got, facing family members who are going through trouble who are sick, and then you've got the economy that's crumbling. You've got when all your coping resources and all your resources that you rely on usually is crumbling and it doesn't help anymore, I think that's when it's going to hit massively scary levels, in that sense, right? And I think that's like what you said earlier, if we can prevent all this from happening or at least try and mitigate it a little bit, it'll be really much more helpful moving forward once we have to get into the recovery phase of all of this. The recovery phase is when we need to be the strongest, the most resilient, to be able to bounce back and say, you know what, it's okay. Bad things have happened, we can get better now, right? So how can we get better now? I think that's going to be really important. That's a really good point there.
Do you have a final message for us, Dr. Joel?
It's crazy times, right? I think it's a situation that it's unprecedented. We've never been through it in our lives before, and we don't even know what's going to happen from here on. There's so much uncertainty. But I think throughout all this uncertainty, throughout all these questions that we have where we don't know what's going to happen, we think about all the worst-case scenarios and all that, despite all of that, I think the best thing that you can do for yourself right now is to zoom in on the here and now, right? What can you be grateful for that you have right now? You have a roof over your head. You've got a meal ready for you after this, for example. Those are the simple things that you can use to try and bring back or try and win back some of that sanity and some of that anxiety that you're feeling in that sense, right? Because when you zoom in on the here and now, you're able to focus on what you can do, something that's something you can work on, something that you can overcome, versus things that are going to happen 8 months, 9 months down the line where we have no idea, we have no control over things. Like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the more we wrest back control about things, the more we're able to say, okay, it's doable, it's manageable, I can do this, right? And that idea, that message that I can do this, that I can survive, is going to be so important moving forward, because that's what's going to tide us over and all through the hard times that we're going to encounter from here on out.
Thank you very much, Dr. Joel.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking to Dr. Joel Lau, clinical psychologist, looking at the impact of COVID-19 on our mental health in the long run, and also what we can do to mitigate that. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.